Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's December 7th, 2014, and welcome to the episode 89 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, this is one thing I'd like to know.
RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and stuff. We love our stuff, especially stuff from the 80s, which, as an amazing coincidence, we're going to talk about stuff from 1988 and 1989. I'm Mike Mulhern, and I'm your host for today, and with me is Paul Hagstrom. Hey, hi, Paul, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine. The weather's starting to get a bit colder here in Boston, and my office is continuing to accumulate that stuff we love. Yeah, everything's good.
Everything's good. Excellent. And over yonder is Jack Nutting in Stockholm, Sweden. Jack, how are you this evening?
Well, I'm just great. Thanks for asking. I'm sitting here in dark, cold, not quite wintry Sweden, but it's cold enough. See, actually, no, it's not cold enough. What am I saying? If it were cold enough, it would be snow outside instead of, like, terrible, drizzly, cold, cold rain all the time. So somehow Sweden has started getting England weather or something. I don't know. We don't have winter anymore.
I'll package it up and send it back.
Yeah.
Now, we've been having a bit of rain here as well, but not quite down your temperatures. It's been consistently in the mid-30s here in Sydney. Very humid, big storms coming in and lashing the east coast of an evening. And we've been through a whole week of sticky and hot during the day and rain, storm, and warm at night. So, weather. It's such fun stuff. But enough of the weather. So last week, or last episode, I should say, we had Ben Heck, and we temporarily put aside 1988. But the Retroscope is back online, and we're going to have a look at 1988 and 1989, or as I like to call it, the boring end of the 80s. it didn't seem to have quite as much happening as in the early 80s, or am I just getting a bit complacent about all these amazing developments that have been coming through?
I think I would have to agree.
What, that I'm complacent, or that the end of the 80s are a bit boring?
I think both.
Things that started to settle.
Yeah, that's true. I think most of the alternative platforms at that time were starting to become obviously just alternative and not like, you know, like you knew that at that time, if you weren't buying a PC or a Mac in some instances, that what you were buying was something that was not going to be relevant pretty soon.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. There's some pretty big changes in the CPU world at this end. And as you said, the platforms had kind of made their presence felt. You could see who was going to be number one and who was going to be number two. Though that number two position wasn't exactly as steady as it could have been, but they've managed to pull through. So let's start with the boxy stuff. So we've got the Amstrad PPC 512, 640. Again, another computer which I didn't get my hands on. Did either of you two guys get to use any of these later Amstrads?
Never at all.
Certainly not. In fact, my awareness of the Amstrad is a fairly recent thing. just being in North America, they didn't really have, as far as I know anyway, they didn't really have any penetration here.
No, yeah, same here. This is something that I've only heard about in recent years. In fact, it's not really totally off my radar at the time in the US, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it was just another interesting style. Then we got the Apple II, 2C Plus. That really is just really a speed bump over the 2C. I know I love my 2C, but I never really got that enamored with the 2C Plus. It just seemed to be, it's faster, it's got a 3.5-inch disc drive, it looks pretty much the same. But, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I am tempted to consider the 2C Plus as one of my favored models, just because it's sort of, it's the end of the line. It's small and portable. That's the one that I always bring. If I'm bringing one somewhere, you know, if I'm traveling for the holidays or going to Kansas Fest or something, it's the 2C Plus that I will bring with me. I think, I forget now what its base speed is, I think 4 megahertz.
4 megahertz, that's right.
Which is, you know, obviously it's much faster, than the 2C or any of the other,
As far as the speed bump goes, 4 times the speed is, a pretty good speed bump. But I'm a little bit biased. I bought the Apple 2C. I still have that 2C, and I don't think I could insult her by bringing a 2C Plus into the house.
Was the 2C Plus the first Apple II model that was that actually went beyond 1 megahertz?
I think the 2GS was released prior to this.
Well, the 2GS, okay. Yeah. Right, yeah. Of course, the 2GS.
Yeah. But as far as the 8-bit 6502 line, yes, I think the 2 Plus was the first one that managed to kick past the megahertz barrier.
Yeah, and it's just got it's an accelerator in it. Basically, it's got a ZIP chip in it. Apple bought the rights to use the ZIP chip in there. And it also has a 3.5-inch drive, which is a slightly inconvenient. It's a mix of convenient and inconvenient, because a lot of the Apple II software wasn't on 3.5-inch discs, and so, those are better when you're going on vacation and to Kansas Fest, but you have to have a way to move stuff over.
Mm. You still need to have a 5.25-inch disc that you can plug in externally so that you can use all the stuff that you already had. Next is the next. So we've got the Cube. A little bit of debate about whether the Cube was here for 88, 89, but I think we've settled on that 89 probably was when it was released, or at least available.
Or maybe even 88. I was looking a bit more. It seems like they released something in 88 that was a limited release and then had a somewhat bigger release in 1990 of an updated piece of updated hardware. But so they had something available in 88, which very few people probably ever saw. I think that machine looked just like the one that came out in 1990, so it's probably hard to know exactly what the difference is.
Mm. There's a very, very striking form factor, very different from everything else that was available at the time. But that's Steve.
Yep, it was a very different thing.
So I think, before we started recording, I think Jack and I had settled on believing that the educational institutions had, as at least some had gotten a pre-release by as early as September 89. So that perhaps running even a pre-release version of Next Step as well.
Yeah, because that's when, so Paul and I went to college together, and that's when we started. And I seem to recall that already in that first year of college that from the beginning there were some Nexts around. I didn't do anything with them really until the year after, but I'm pretty sure that we had some there. So this must have been this very early one that, as I recall, it was running like Nextstep 0.8 or 0.9 or something. So it was all very, very clearly pre-release. But despite that, it actually worked pretty well. And like the monitor was beautiful in grayscale, actually. And it was a quite nice machine in many ways.
I remember being kind of surprised that learning that the monitor, the graphics was basically being driven by PostScript. That seemed crazy to me.
Oh, well, the screen's just another document format, I suppose.
Pretty much. But the crazy thing is that PostScript is essentially, it's an interpreted stack-based programming language. You know, it's not like, it's a much more complicated thing to render than just, say, you know, a chunk of memory representing pixels. Because, it's everything is essentially a program. In fact, I remember a few years later doing, when I started consulting, we did some report generation running on Next Step, where a lot of the logic for actually rendering what was going to be in the report was done in PostScript. So you'd have, you're pulling data out of a database and then running it, essentially filtering it into a PostScript program that would then take that and expand it out. And like within PostScript, we'd be figuring out how many pages it's going to be and like where to do all the layout and all this sort of stuff. Pretty weird, but actually very cool.
Yeah, well, being in the document print industry myself, you do see PostScript documents that are really more than just documents. They're not just laying text and graphics onto the page. They're actually doing some serious computational work in there. So you need to be quite good with what you're doing so that you can get that processed in fast time. When you're doing it commercially, you don't really want to be sitting around waiting for it to happen. You need it to be done pretty quick. So you need to run it and then rip it so we can get it out onto the documents. But PostScript, that's lots of fun. Never thought of using it as a display driver myself, but why not?
It worked really well as the display model. And the interesting thing was that it let you could code your applications to draw everything on screen, and then printing whatever you drew on screen was essentially a no-op. Like, you didn't have to, sort of redirected, you would call a method to one place instead of another, and you would draw it on ready for print. You didn't have to sort of figure out, okay, here's what I'm looking like on screen, now how am I going to, format that for print? You were already done.
Yeah, and all your resolutions and everything taken care of so that at a lower resolution on the screen looks pretty good. Then you direct it to your printer, and even then the laser printers that were available were pretty good. And I remember seeing PostScript output at that stage. It was just superb on paper. It was definitely that I thought that was where things were going, but it didn't quite end up going that way. Not until PDFs came along. But no, PostScript's still out there in the commercial world and doing some pretty serious stuff. So keeps me in a job.
You know, I was while you guys were talking about that, I was Googling around to try to see if anyone had ported Doom to PostScript, but apparently they have not.
Oh, there it is. It's failed.
That's a retro challenge project.
Yeah.
Oh, we have to mention the retro challenge, but we'll get to that.
We'll get to that one. So, heading back Applewood, we have also the Laser 128 and the EX and EX2. So, this is basically the Apple IIc clones, but in some aspects, I think that they were actually better machines than the IIc. At least you could use an expansion bus off it and plug bits in. The 2C, 2C Plus were still physically closed devices. But I think these Laser 128, that's pretty much the end of the Apple clone world until the Mac clones start coming along. But that's not for a few years yet. So did either of you gents get to use any of the Laser 128 series?
No.
Never did.
I've seen them. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Laser 128 is the one that has a naked expansion slot on the side.
Yep. Oh, yes. you can't get any closer to the motherboard.
It seems unsafe.
Well.
But, I mean, I guess not. I suppose it might be a little bit like the Timex Sinclairs and stuff always had, or the ZX81s always had this, common problem of the RAM expander just sort of falling out when you're trying to use them, as I recall.
Well, they were more portable machines rather than relocatable machines. They weren't portable in the sense of laptops or notebooks, so you didn't have to really worry about anything coming loose from the expansion port while you're using it. Though the way it was done, it did kind of just hang out at the side, so I suppose it was prone to being bumped and knocked, but it was a nice machine. Had minor compatibility issues, but then again, the 2C Plus had compatibility issues with its built-in accelerator. But that was just part of the game back then. Okay, well, little computer which I'm trying to get hold of one for myself is the Cambridge Computer Z88. Now, that's a interesting little device. It's almost a full-size keyboard, a small LCD display. It's quite an interesting little machine.
Was this a battery-driven device?
Or a wall wart that you can plug in, but has batteries.
So this is kind of similar to, I'm thinking of this TRS-80 what's that, the Model 100 or whatever, in some sense, right? This is like, it's basically you have this tiny screen. You can do, so you have enough to be able to do some word processing and that sort of thing in a portable way. That's pretty cool. Were these full travel keys, or was it the kind of chiclety, trying to see based on some screenshots and not or some pictures on
it? Well, it uses a membrane keyboard, but it's a little bit better than other ones. So we're definitely not talking ZX81 style keys. And as far as chiclets go, I've never actually touched one, but it's more the form factor that I quite quite like.
Interesting.
But again, it's might be a few of our British listeners might have one in their collection. Wouldn't mind knowing a little information about that firsthand on how does it feel, what expansion bits that do you have for it?
Yeah, I kind of like the things that are this size are nice just because, you know, they don't take up a lot of room. But
yeah, it was a direction that portable computing didn't really take off. I think even back then it was pretty much, you know, people would have been limited by the size of the display. People were becoming used to using a CRT or a monitor or a TV as a monitor, and I think the age of the small LCD screen that was there on the programmable calculators had reached its end of its currency.
Right. Still seems like a pretty interesting little device there, but I had never even heard of this thing before. Do you know where this was? This sold primarily in the UK?
Yeah, it's a UK one. So I believe the development team were ex-Sinclair employees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, and then we've got the 68030 going into the Apple II, giving us the Apple IIX.
It didn't go into the Apple II.
Oh, sorry. There we are. That'd be the Macintosh II. Why did they do that? They did that to annoy me on purpose, I'm sure.
Yep.
But yeah, so we're basically seeing the 68,000 range well and truly into the max. But in 89, Intel released the 486 DX, so the Intel world is really getting a kick along, and it was the DX266 a few years down the track that became my first Windows machine that I bought. But this is the start of the 486 DX. So we've got our maths coprocessor built in, pretty good architecture, and really Intel had basically consolidated themselves, I think, with the 486 range of the CPU. Everyone was basically clamoring to copy what they had. So you got the Cyrex processors, but this is pretty much the big time for the Intel machines, and then paired with Windows. And I'm sorry for the rest of us, but I think we kind of got left eating dust after this.
Mm-hmm. I've always kind of wondered if it was sort of a coincidence that it seems like the numbers in the 68,000 and the you know, the 80x86 tracked a little bit. You know, it sort of seemed like the 68030 is kind of comparable to the 386, and you know, the 68040 had the math processor built in like the 486 does. You know, so I sort of think of them in those generational terms, you know, that the 68040 is kind of like parallel to the 486. I don't know if that's just if I'm inventing that, but at least the timeline seems fairly close.
That's roughly how I seemed to envision it at the time. Although I think if you look at the comparative functionality of things, I think this is really the time when Intel started to really leap ahead of Motorola in terms of processor performance. So I think you could compare the 486 to the 68040, but I think the 68040 I think came a little bit later and was probably not quite as good as the 486 DX. I mean, this is sort of, you know, a little bit comparing apples and oranges, but I think this was kind of the beginning of the end for Motorola's existing CPU architecture family at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps that's the kind of the way I started to see it at the time, and still think I see it.
Yeah, for me it was a case of that I was seeing that the performance was available in the Intel processors, coupled with Windows, and versus the price of the Apple Macintosh, and that pretty much put me into the Windows camp for the next decade, really. Well, even more than a decade. I was a Windows user right up to Windows 2000, so yeah.
I guess in the Motorola camp, there were some alternatives, both the Amiga and the Atari ST that we talked about, but they had, of course, their own problems. And also, I think both of those machines, both the Atari ST and the Amiga, they eventually got 68030s and 68040s, but they were not cheap. I mean, the 68,000 devices were cheap, but their higher-end devices were not cheap compared to comparable Macs or anything. So like what you're saying, price performance-wise, there really was nothing in the Motorola CPU world that was like a good quality and reasonably cheap machine with a high-end processor.
Yeah, and also you were basically seeing the advent of the PC stores where you could actually go in and select the motherboard that you wanted, the CPU that went with that motherboard from a range. You know, pick all the bits and pieces that you want, the case that you wanted, and basically it was a not quite do-it-yourself computing. You could put all the bits together yourself, but that was the other thing that I liked, that I was able to sort of go into a store and check out the latest motherboards and see what they had on it and building it all up. And it was something that you couldn't do with a lot of other machines, especially the Macs, the SEs. Yes, you could open them, but they were pretty much a limited internal expansion. And the Macintosh 2 series, I just couldn't put the money together to get one of those machines.
I think you could open them, the SE line, but they sure didn't want you to. They used a weird, funny, long-handled screwdriver, torque screwdriver to get them open.
Yeah, 6-inch or 8-inch shaft on a T15 head.
Wasn't there also a weird tool, a weird sort of clam-cracking tool that you would put into the wedge of the case to open it up along a wider spread instead of using a screwdriver to wreck your case?
Oh, I've never had much trouble opening them up, but
there was that tool, though. Yeah,
yeah. I think on some of the newer machines, the cracker would have been good. I think would definitely back would have made it a lot easier.
It's what my experience with those is primarily that if you let gravity do it, then you don't have to worry so much about cracking the case because the screen is super heavy. So it's just, put it on its face and pull the back off.
Yeah, I just get a towel folded several times on top of a blanket and, as you said, take the screws out, and then I usually just hold on to the sides of the back case with my palms open and just give it a sharp lift up, and in most cases that takes the back off, and sometimes it's just a case of letting the monitor gently fall out an inch.
There you go.
Right.
Never had too many problems opening up those Toaster Macs. But that was basically when you were buying them for considerably less than their new price.
Yeah, right. So another thing that's here in 1989, which I am extremely fond of, is the SE30. So we've been already just talking about these SE, I think of this as basically the last good compact Mac. Although, I mean, there were a couple that came after it, like the Classic and the Classic 2 and things like that. But they
were color.
Yeah. The SE30 was the last black and white. And it was so much faster than the SE. It was, it lasted a long time. If you look at surveys online about, like, what's the best, what's your favorite Mac, this one ends up topping a lot of lists of people who are using Macs in that era. So, yeah, this was my first Mac. And I don't think it's just that makes me like it so much. And also at that same, pretty much the same time, the 2CX replaced the 2X. And this was also the beginning of the crazy model years at Apple, where there was the 2CX, which then made way to the 2CI. There are Quadras and Centrises. I don't understand why anybody thought it was a good idea in those later years to differentiate the exact same machine by Quadra and Centris and, you know, the different slash numbers indicating the processor speed.
Oh, it confused the heck out of me then, and I still have trouble following it.
It certainly does not make me want to collect every possible model.
No. Yeah, it's like there's this idea that having some sort of weird jargon is going to make things more interesting or exciting or valuable seeming. I don't know. I think if you look at what compared to what Apple does now, where it's just like, you're getting a MacBook Pro and you pick the amount of RAM, and like there's not a different model number for, well, I guess technically there probably is somewhere internally in Apple systems, right? There's a, you know, there's one product with this size hard drive, one with that size, but it's nothing the consumer knows about or has to think about. It seems much more obvious to do it this way than what they were doing then.
Okay, so it's computer related, but the next item I've got here is Creative Labs released the Sound Blaster card. Now, I thought this was actually interesting for two reasons. One, it was a decent piece of kit for the PC world, but the thing I think is most important about this is that you have a card manufacturer now with the putting the advertising out there so that, you know, it's not just a sound card, it's a creative sound blaster. You know, people were now asking for this particular sound card by name rather than, I want sound capability in my Windows PC. Now, it had to be a sound blaster. Mind you, it was a bit of a pain at times getting the IRQs and all the memory addresses and whatnot sorted out to get rid of any conflicts, but that was just part of the joys of programming in DOS.
Those many joys.
The Sound Blaster was kind of a standard for a while, I think, after that.
Oh, yes, yes. That's right. Had to be Sound Blaster compatible.
So another podcast that makes it into my feed, the DOS Nostalgia podcast, the most recent episode that was released as we're recording this now, has a really long and detailed kind of discussion of the different sound cards on the PC platform, comparing the capabilities of the different ones and so forth. But so for people who are interested in the, you know, the minute details of these, it's worth listening to, but it's very detailed.
Before the Sound Blaster came out, what were the alternatives for PC sound? I mean, the only thing that I recall on the PC before the Sound Blaster was like the typical sort of bleeps and bloops you had on the original IBM PC. Like, it seems like there was this great void of nothingness where anything that made sound was just making very simplistic sounds. And then you went to the Sound Blaster where suddenly you had, you know, suddenly you could have games and things that, and multimedia stuff that actually had decent sound. Was there anything really before that? It was a reasonable alternative?
I was trying to find out before the show what was available. I remember that I used to play with some system utilities for sound generation, but that was really just playing with the PC speaker.
Mm-hmm.
That was still roughly at the same time as the Creative Labs were releasing the Sound Blaster range. So there was definitely nothing on the motherboard at that stage, apart from a beep.
Yeah, the PC sound was terrible, but, you know, sort of internally. But
I think there were some basic sound cards at that stage, but I can't find anything in downstairs in my library because I've kept all my bits and pieces of, you know, brochures and release media and stuff of that time. But I just can't find the box that all of this stuff is in. The joys of moving and trying to sort things out.
Well, I think, my understanding is that the Adlib card actually was probably, you know, that predated the Sound Blaster. I have it down, you know, on my screen it says 1987, so that would have been a little before that, and King's Quest IV would be the first PC game to support that. But with all of these things, it seems like really what you need is some kind of market saturation, you know, so people who are writing games will write them for the Sound Blaster or the Adlib if there are enough people that have them.
Right.
Well, that was the thing. When you were installing DOS games, normally in the setup thing there was normally half a dozen or more options that were available for the sound support that you were going to have for that game. Maybe I'd be best served by going and setting up one of those games and seeing what options were there.
I think it's interesting, this notion that like prior to that, I think most of what was on a PC was considered standard stuff on a PC in terms of, you know, VGA out and parallel ports and serial ports, and the basic components of what it would do were driven by the PC manufacturers, right? Like they're deciding what's going to go in there. And this is maybe one of the first cases where someone doing kind of third-party hardware comes up with a thing and it's able to get enough penetration that it becomes a sort of a standard. So like by the mid-90s, no one was buying a PC without some kind of built-in sound capability, and almost all of that was by that time probably Sound Blaster compatible, like you say.
Well, that was pretty much the options that were on there, so that for install predominantly the games. But as we're talking about, there were so many but so limited options out there that perhaps it was actually part of their marketing campaign to make people see this as the standard, have programmers develop the games to use this sound card as the standard, and they basically advertised their way into becoming for quite a while the de facto standard. Because no, even with your drive cards and everything was plugged into a slot at one stage on your PC motherboard. Very little was actually peripherally built into the board. So if you wanted a drive controller card, serial parallel port interfaces, video display, they were all plugged into a card slot off the motherboard. And this is one way of sort of like forcing your product, in this case Creative Labs, Sound Blaster, into the de facto standard.
Even the 5150, the first PC had, the video was all controlled by what card you put in. You could put in a monochrome card, you could put in a color graphics adapter, or, you know, later an EGA. I think EGA would go in there. So even that level of connectivity wasn't on the board. Those at least were mostly marketed by IBM. I think Hercules had a very popular card. Not sure exactly. I sort of have vague memories of everyone buying Hercules cards for a while.
Okay. Well, I think we've given enough free advertising to Creative Labs. Okay. Another one which I'm only aware of is the Atari Lynx. So, that looks like it's a games. I thought it was a controller, but it's actually a game console, is it?
Yep, it's a game console, handheld. So this came out at the time when the only other real competition there out was the original Game Boy, which had a tiny little monochrome screen, and the Lynx suddenly had like a nice color screen. It actually held its own for quite a while. I never had one. I've had friends who had some, and people still like collecting them today. I remember buying a Sega Game Gear that came out a few years later, and I think I was kind of disappointed that it was definitely not any better than the Lynx was. So it was a pretty nice machine in many ways, I think. And I just sort of tossed in there, this is sort of one of the last consumer-oriented things that Atari tried to do and had any kind of success with at all.
Well, okay, well, we've touched on the next one while talking about our friendly, and he puts that in quotes, DOS systems. So 1988, more of a date that Microsoft don't want us to remember, and many of us wish we could forget. MS-DOS 4 is released. This was so successful that it drove most DOS users back into DOS 3.3. Now, you may have heard stories about DOS 4 being buggy and problematic and causing issues, and I would just like to confirm that. It was. even when 4.01 was released, and this was one major bug stomp in 4.01, by that stage, people were going, no way. So I was one of these people. I stayed with DOS 3.3. That until DOS 5 was released in 91. Actually, I was probably a very late adopter of DOS 5. MS-DOS 4, definitely one for the collectors, because all you want is the case or the box on your shelf. You do not want this on any of your machines.
Now, is there even any sort of entertainment value these days in firing up MS-DOS 4 in an emulator just to see how buggy it was?
It would bring back pain, I think, for me. I have a IBM DOS 4 in a box. I found that company where I was working. They were doing a clean out, and that was just in a pile of stuff to be thrown out. And I said, can I have that? And they said, well, we're just throwing it out. Take it. So I just put that, that just sits on my shelf just to remind me of some of the darker days of DOS. But yeah, I didn't use DOS 5 that much at all. I suppose I really went from DOS 3.3 to the 6.22, the final Microsoft DOS release. This is what brought it up. Never use an even version of an even version or .0 release of DOS. On a happier note, in 89, CorelDRAW was released, and this again pretty much became the art package, I suppose, of the day, and was pretty much also the start of the mega clip art collections that came with all these packages. I remember walking into computer stores and seeing CorelDRAW throughout its various iterations, and floppy disk and then later CD clip art collections, and putting in there that they all worked with CorelDRAW. Another interesting package.
Now, is this something, I know you work with print a lot. Is this something that you feel like, do you still see after effects of this today in terms of what's available today, what people are using today?
I don't know about in that side of things, but I still see the after effects of it in their PowerPoint presentations. all that kitschy clip art.
Yeah, there's that. Did any of you guys see, I think I saw a news item in the past week or two that, was it Microsoft saying they were going to ditch all of the clip art in Office?
Yeah, they're not including any clip art with Office anymore. They're basically going to be, it's still connections to their photo collection, so So basically they're going away from the line, vector, clip art, kitschy little cartoony type things, and basically going with a photo style. So
right.
I suppose clip art's still there. It's just evolving to something different.
Now it's photo art.
Photo art, yes. This one sounds more important. SimCity released the original. I remember getting this running on my little DOS boxes.
Yeah, I remember wasting many, many hours with the original SimCity.
I was sort of aware of its existence, but I never could really stick with it for more than like 20 minutes in a row. So
I played for a bit longer than that, it wasn't quite didn't have me captivated. I ended up being more of a Civilizations player. I still test out all my new computers by seeing how I can get Civ 2 running on them. So. Be it through a DOS box or some other DOS emulator system, or emulating Windows and running that. So I sort of always look at part of that as part of my game customization of whatever computer I've got, that I can get Civ 2 or Civ 1 for DOS running on the most current platform that I can have my hands on.
So that's sort of a baseline. If you know you can get that running, then you can figure you can bring any classic game from this era running decently.
Oh, that's some people want to get Doom running on whatever computer that they use. I'm more of a Sid Meier's Civ guy, but SimCity it interested me. I think I just like plotting the bits and pieces out there, and then I'd sort of like, yeah, that's fine, turn it off and go away and do something that I'm supposed to be doing.
So I was reading, it was interesting, apparently this was developed like 4 or 5 years earlier, first for the Commodore 64, and then it seemed to languish and bounced around a bit from publisher to publisher, and then eventually it was released in 89. I don't know what the original platforms were. I think it was Mac and PC, and I seem to recall that I played it on the Amiga a couple of years later. I don't know just what platforms it came on first, but I remember playing it on various machines at various points. I never liked any of the sequels much, but the first one, it had a sort of, I think because it was so simplistic in terms of its graphics, there was something kind of iconic about the graphics that was that I appealed to me in some way. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was actually I think it was Mac and Amiga were the first two platforms. Even though it was, I read the same thing that it was developed on the Commodore 64 initially.
Yeah, obviously that spawned a whole series of sequels in years to come.
Yeah, and all those sequels they didn't do anything for me either. So yeah, the original and the best, I think.
Now it's ended up being The Sims, which is turned into a whole. It's a huge franchise of, like, they sell so many add-ons, they sell so much stuff. So you buy The Sims and you have, like, so one of my daughters is into this game. And, like, you buy all these packs of additional content for all these little things. And it's not about running a city, it's about running a household, essentially. You have your little people and you can sort of decide what they're going to do and how they're going to do their stuff. It's actually, weirdly, it's like it's returned all the way back to the original Little Computer People. What was that, 1984 or so?
Mm.
Who remembers that? that's what SimCity has turned into is the Sims.
Yeah, relative TV meets the computer.
Yeah.
And I think we can close out the 80s with this little thing. Tim Berners-Lee uses hypertext to link documents and information across computer systems. The idea, it caught on. Even though there would have been naysayers back then.
I can mention, I saw the very first WWW app on Next that a professor showed me. And I remember thinking and saying to him, what is the use of this? Who's going to use this for anything? This is not going to go anywhere. Hypertext, who cares? I think I was wrong.
Yeah, not did it just go anywhere. It went everywhere.
It didn't do anything Gopher didn't do.
I'd agree with that back then. But, if a small idea spawned something big, huge, and world-spanning, this was it. It really did change the way that we interact with our computers and systems. So, as I said, this idea, it did catch on big time. That's 1988 and 1989 in a nutshell. I still don't think it was as exciting as the early end of the 80s. Yes, there were some big developments. You can't go past the web, can you? But to close it out, but I think I'll always be a late 70s, early 80s kind of guy.
Yep, I have to agree. I feel like most of what came out in the later part of the 80s, it was mostly just kind of iterating on what was already there. You had, sure, there were new machines, there was new stuff going on, but there was more. I think it was more marked by what was not there anymore. So many platforms had disappeared, you know, were not relevant anymore. You couldn't buy software for them anymore.
Yeah, even by this stage, so much had gone by the way. But I think we're now coming into it's more evolutionary than revolutionary. So,
yep.
Oh well, we all wave goodbye to the 80s.
So long.
Okay, items of news and interest. Okay, well, I'll start this off. The biggie for me is that the EDSAC display at the National Museum of Computing has opened. It's one of those things I would have really liked to have been there to see this come to fruition, because this is part of our computing history that quite nearly was totally lost. It's all been brought back by people bringing in bits and pieces. They've been re-engineering all the chassis, getting hold of all the equipment, and building it all back from nothing. There weren't even, as far as I know, any existing working componentry. So everything's been rebuilt from the design notes and the blueprints, schematics, and everything that they had available. So definitely a wonderful display to see if you're off to the National Museum of Computing. And I think if I ever get over to that end of the world, I'm going to have to dedicate more than just a couple of days to checking out everything that they've got there. But if you want to have a look at the Electronic Delay Storage Automatic Calculator, as EDSAC was known, so this is a computer that developed out of the computer technologies post-World War II, quite different to what we've ended up using in our computers, but it's definitely something showing the pre-transistor big computing era.
Yep, that is a really impressive effort. Pretty amazing that they're able to reconstruct this thing after all this time from nothing and from plans for the most part. I'm thinking, since I actually am in this part of the world, in this corner of the world, more or less. England's not so far from Sweden. I wonder if I should try and weasel my way into a trip over here for some reason. I'll make up some pretense. Honey, we need to go to England. I found something amazing. And then I'll sneak off and go and see this.
It'll keep you warm during winter.
Yeah.
Someone open the door and let some snow in. But I've talked about this one in the past, but pretty much the display is open. So anyone who's in town, go have a look. And the link in the show notes, and it'll show information on the reconstruction project, what's actually on display, and where they're going from here. So, Paul, while we're talking about big computers, you have one that's been rescued from a scrap heap rather than being built up out of nothing.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting story. I mean, it doesn't have this... Well, so this is about ENIAC. It turns out that at a certain point in, 2006, Ross Perot, who you might recall if you are, if you remember the 80s, when was actually, I forget when he ran, but anyway, it might have been actually 92 or something, right? But
yeah, I think so.
At any rate, yes. So Ross Perot had declared an interest in decorating his office with relics from computing history. And, you know, he's a big, rich guy. And so his staffers went off and they decided to try to get him some of the ENIAC, which is the Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer, a 27-ton, 1,800-square-foot bundle of vacuum tubes and diodes that's described here. I'm not all that well-versed in ENIAC, but I think there is just the one. I think there is ENIAC. There's not several of them. There's just the one which was used to calculate shell trajectories in World War II. They fired it up after World War II ended, but that was the that was sort of the idea, at least. So apparently the Army, when it finally decided that ENIAC was obsolete, 1955, it just sort of got distributed, you know, into many different pieces all around. Much of it scrapped, and some people wound up with front panels and things like that, but mostly they just went into like big crates in warehouses. And so Ross Perot's what is her name? Libby Kraft, I think.
Yes. Yeah, Director for Special Projects.
Yeah. So she was sort of searching around and found that Oklahoma's Fort Sill had actually a fairly large collection of ENIAC bits. They had 9 panels just sort of stored in a big Raider-style warehouse. And so basically those panels were, I guess, sort of loaned to the Ross Perot company in exchange for basically sort of restoring them and so forth, so they were actually on display in Perot's office building, but no normal person could go in there, and recently they've just been moved back. Recently, like 5 years ago, they went back to Fort Sill, and in late October they went on display. The story itself is actually just a recent Wired article, but apparently the panels themselves have been there since October. So if you're in Oklahoma, it would be interesting to see this, just little bits of preserved ENIAC.
It's a pity they couldn't get it rebuilt and operational, but as far as a static display, that is still very impressive.
Well, and it's kind of a neat story too. Just to, big rich guy decides, okay,
I want to redecorate.
Yeah, I want old vintage computer stuff. And so it winds up with an ENIAC or the ENIAC.
Yes. So he's just like us, but with slightly more disposable income.
Right.
That reminds me. I don't remember where I saw or heard or read the story, but somebody worked someplace where, their boss wanted to have some retro computers to decorate his office with, but he asked if he could essentially borrow some things from his staff, and he got in some things, and he had someone just bolt them to the walls, like literally like drive bolts straight through entire machines, which kind of made them not really functional anymore. I think their staff weren't super happy about it. This is more modern retro computing stuff that we have. It was not like ENIAC style, but still along the lines of kind of deranged boss decides, let's decorate it with something. But at least in Perot's case, it seems like he actually, his staffers took the opportunity to try and do something good with these things instead of just wreck them.
Yeah, it looks like they went and used the bolt-free method. So, Jack.
Yes, I found an interesting article. I actually found this right before we started talking, so I haven't even watched it yet. But there seems to be an interesting video on Bloomberg TV, a segment with Nolan Bushnell, Ted Dabney, and Al Alcorn talking about the creation of Atari. So Nolan Bushnell and Ted Dabney, they started Atari in 1971 and hired Al Alcorn the following year as their first sort of chip designer, or not chip designer, maybe system designer. And so Al Alcorn was really kind of the one of the head people in charge of many of their early efforts in terms of their stand-up video games and also their Atari 2600 video game system, the home system, and a lot of other things. So he's kind of considered the mastermind behind many of their technical achievements of the time. And I have not yet watched this video. It's only 7 minutes long, but people were saying good things about it on the internets. So probably worth watching if anyone's interested in a little bit of old Atari history. And that'll be in the show notes, of course.
Well, I've just got and added that to my watch list, so yep. Okay, well, a little bit of Apple memorabilia that's not an Apple One is being talked about now. So Steve Wozniak and Ron Wayne basically just having a chat and just going over the different bits of memorabilia. So if you can't find $1 million for a Apple One, then maybe this is the kind of memorabilia that you need to start looking at. It's a little bit of the paperwork. I've seen in over the past incorporation documents and other bits and pieces of early Apple legal paperwork come up, and quite interesting. The story between Ron Wayne and the Steves is also interesting, how he came in briefly there, bought out for $800 and continued on his way, and he doesn't seem to have too many regrets about not staying with Apple. It wasn't what he was into at that time. He basically helped start up the company, and that was what he wanted to do, and hopped out. But then again, I suppose you can't tear yourself apart after all these years. So Steve Wozniak and him have been chatting about the memorabilia of those days.
Yeah, it seems like it'd be interesting to see these documents, but I don't need to own them.
No.
No. I don't need to own an Apple One, even if I did have $1 million to spare. It's just so many more, even to me, more interesting things that I could get into my collection. I'll let other people worry about the Apple One. As I said, it's not really my thing. The history of it all is quite interesting. Okay, so, Paul, Sinclair ZX Spectrum Vega.
Yeah, so this is something, I saw this pop up, you know, on the various feeds a little while ago, and at first I just thought, this is a joke, right? But apparently it isn't a joke. So Sir Clive Sinclair and Retro Computers Limited are pleased to announce the launch of the Sinclair ZX Spectrum Vega. And so what it is what it looks like. It's in the style of a ZX Spectrum, ZX Spectrum. But it has a little four-way arrow key on the left, and then five keys. One that says run, one that says four, one that says save, and then one and two. And, you know, what it apparently is in fact a new run of, something that will run the Spectrum games, I think. And as I say, I'm not all that familiar with this project, except my initial reaction was this was some sort of like Onion story or something. But in fact, actually, it is going to be, there's an Indiegogo campaign, and actually, is it, still going on?
Yes. It's only got 54 days left.
But they have achieved the goal already, so they're in.
Yeah, although I think Indiegogo is one of these that you don't have to cross the threshold in order to actually make the project, or get the money, at least.
Oh, okay.
But so my understanding is, though, that it basically runs Spectrum games, and is, you know, it's not a Spectrum, but it's, you know, like it is new hardware. And it, part of the reason I thought it was a joke was that, you know, surely some of these things on the spectrum you need to type, right? You can't really get away with A, B, 1, and 2. But, so I don't know exactly how that is handled, but I'm sort of curious about it. Did anyone else here look at this before, before now?
I saw this when it came, also, as you said, came across the feeds. I saw this here and there. And I don't know anything more details about this. I'm guessing that it says somewhere in here this is done with a clever microcontroller. I'm guessing this is not, you know, that probably does not contain an actual Z80 or anything of the sort. It's probably something, it might be some FPGA type of thing, or it might be some other microprocessor running essentially an emulator of some kind. I really don't know. But it seems like, what is it going to cost? £100 or something? So it's not super cheap or anything. It seems like, you know, you would think they ought to be able to make it a whole lot cheaper than what it is. I don't know.
Well, maybe they're hoping for a lot of profit.
Could be, and they might get it. I think it's an interesting idea, and I think this is comparable to, nowadays you can buy this Atari flashback system that plays all these old 2600 games that you just plug straight into your TV. So I think they're trying to tap into probably the same kind of idea of that. Like, hey, there are some people who remember this old stuff, but they don't want to be bothered with actually dealing with the old hardware. Let's sell a package they can just plug in and play with. I don't know to what extent it is the case that Spectrum games actually only need those four buttons plus the directional pad. Like you said, I wondered about that too. It's like, you must have to type something somewhere. It could be that they've actually modified some games. Maybe there were games that just had, maybe they've sort of cherry-picked, said, let's find games and only need those, or I really don't know. I've almost never played with the Spectrum at all, so I don't really know what was normal.
Well, I'm looking at the frequently asked questions at the end, and one of the questions is, can I connect a keyboard? The answer being, we're reviewing our expansion options. Another one was, what file format will work on the SD card, suggesting that you can actually sort of put your own Spectrum stuff on something to put in. So even more likely that you're going to wind up, you know, trying to, you know, run Zork or something where, you know, like the only thing you, like, is there anything you can do? Let's see, RFS. We don't even have any vowels. So, right.
Up, up, down, down, left, right.
Now, if I'd first seen this, I definitely would have thought it was coming from ONN, but it looks interesting. I was seeing in here that part of it is making arrangements for owners of the software rights for Spectrum games to donate combined software royalties to charity. So there's some goodness going on in here, as well as just some retro goodness. But definitely interesting.
I think I wouldn't mind having one. I don't have anything, and I don't have anything that you know, apart from an emulator I could install but have not installed, that could run these things. So we sort of need to have it to try. But I'm not sure that sort of need is going to translate into my actually buying one.
Yeah. Okay. And Jack, if you can take us out of the news section on places you can play Pong.
Well, you know, I love playing Pong everywhere that I can. And someone in Germany has come up with a way to play Pong while you're waiting to cross the street. So there's a video out with, I don't think this is a very widespread thing. I think they've set up in one spot where if you're standing on the sidewalk waiting to cross the street and you have a red light, you can play Pong against the person who is at the other side of the street also waiting to cross the street. I think it seems interesting. I think there are some problems. Like if I'm standing on the street, like right next to the street, I kind of want to keep my eyes open because there could be, a car or there could be a bicyclist or, you know, a pickpocket. Like, it seems like, I don't really want to get that intent on, like, focusing on what's attached to a pole right in front. I don't know. But it's a fun idea, though, I guess. Of course, I think the real thing will be when someone ports Doom to run on the traffic light system. That's what we'll really want.
I don't know. Walking around in Sydney CBD is pretty much like Doom.
Well, you know, and the thing is that at some point, you know, the light's going to change, and you want to be on the other side of the street. And I just wonder to what extent this will slow you down. It's like, well, yeah, except I'm winning.
Do you get a prize if you beat the brick over to the other side?
That'd be awesome. So this thing just has it's showing you Pong on the display. I guess the ultimate thing would be that Pong would be displayed on the road in front of you, the projection system. That's what you really want.
Or even just have like a physical ball that just crosses the street and you know, you lose if a car hits the ball. This is getting like a worse and worse idea.
I think we'll leave that one. It's host retro computing gift idea time. Well, not quite retro, though I suppose it's Lego itself has been around for a while, but here's a not Lego idea. Build on a mug from one of my favorite websites of ThinkGeek. So when you're having your coffee or tea or some other beverage of choice, you can be clipping bricks onto your mug and building little designs, skyscrapers, Star Wars minifigs jump to mind. But a little something different for your Lego collection. So I don't know about you two guys, but I like my Lego. I'm just waiting to get the table set up downstairs where I can get my robotics Lego back out and start playing with some of the projects that I was doing before I moved, but have now just been boxed temporarily, though temporarily is a nebulous thing. I think one of these projects I was working on was 5-6 more years ago, but I'll get back to it.
All in due time,
that's right. And in the meantime, I can play with my Lego and drink my coffee at the same time, so...
I'm not sure I would look forward to washing, you know, like, washing stuff out of all the little holes and things.
If you dribble it on the outside, but I was just looking at my coffee mug here, and really it just gets a boiling water rinse before use. It has a seasoned interior to enhance the taste of the coffee.
Yeah, so I have some of those... you know, the Lego robotic stuff, too. And I think it would be an interesting project to take this and then, you know, rig up some sort of thing where it can feed you coffee while you type.
as it should serve its master.
Another Retro Challenge idea. And also, we should mention Retro Challenge.
Yes, it's Retro Challenge time. So I'm gun-shy. I've got to come up with a new retro project which will be doomed to failure. But yes, we will include links to the Retro Challenge. So when you're not shoveling snow or avoiding electrical storms or whatever afflicts your part of the world, the Retro Challenge, I believe it can be fun.
Yeah. And I believe projects can be finished in principle.
In principle. It sounds more like a theory to me. It needs a little bit of, some demonstration of some sound principles. Definitely on my ideas, anyway.
So could one of you guys tell me sort of like what are the general parameters of the Retro Challenge? I'm not familiar with this.
It's the parameters are fairly loose. You take your retro device of choice and you do something with it. You program something on it, you program something with it, you make something for it, or you make something on it. It's fairly open-ended. Pop over to the Retro Challenge website. As I said, we'll have a link in there, and it'll show you some of the past projects and some amazingly, the ones that were completed, and some of them are quite amazing people.
Yeah, so the site is retrochallenge.net, and they do this twice a year. It used to be that the one that's in, yeah, it's like around July, I think, was the main one, and the January one was the winter warm-up, but this one seems to be... So it's basically from January 1st to January 31st, 2015, this particular round of the Retro Challenge, and it includes all those things you mentioned, but also I've seen people... It's really open-ended. So, I mean, I've also seen people as their Retro Challenge project, say they're going to, you know, like, or organize their retro computing collection or, you know, clean something or whatever. So there is a kind of a competition to it, but it's, ultimately I think it's basically just, the winners are chosen by, you know, what seems cool and seems finished. It's basically just, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, It's using other people's participation in the projects at the same time to kind of motivate you to finish something. I've started maybe three of these things and every time it's wound up being essentially, you know, the 25th of January and I'm thinking, oh, well, okay. I guess I didn't really get past the project definition, but.
No, it's definitely worth a look at. And, if you can, participate, that's great. Come up with your idea. Send it in, blog about it during the 1 month period. Get on Twitter. It was the last one just passed the tweets on that. It was amazing what people were doing, and just popping over, having a look at the blog sites, what they're doing. And unfortunately, mine was somewhat less exciting, as not much was on the doing. But yeah, as I said, I'll have to come up with something that might be slightly more achievable, so that at least when I fail, I don't fail quite so drastically.
One of the things that actually you know, sort of defines participating in this is keeping kind of like a running blog, which is linked to from the site, and that people can sort of read to see what other people are doing. So so that is fun, even if you don't manage to participate.
Cool.
Well, we'll all put our thinking caps on and see what we can come up with.
Why, pay attention, Bond. This is the Sinclair ZX Spectrum Plus 2. It's a fully operational computer with 128K memory, but it comes with 3 James Bond games and a light gun that fires armor-piercing shells. Now that's your assignment. No, no, don't sit in that chair! Sorry, Bond. Haven't perfected that yet. The Sinclair ZX Spectrum Plus 2.
Let's see what's out there in eBay land. So, Paul, what have you selected for us?
What have I selected for us? Oh, in a kind of a rush, what I picked was SimCity, because I thought, you know, all right, this had a big, big influence, and 1989 themed. So the link I have to the is just to one seemingly relatively reasonable auction for SimCity Mac 1989. It was picked just because it was the first you know, edition from 1989. I imagine that you can find other auctions easily enough. This particular one is a $23 buy it now, and actually the shipping's a little high for what it is. I could ship it for less than that, but at any rate, I think we've talked enough about SimCity, but it's kind of neat to see the real thing.
Well, Even getting an original copy of SimCity working on a modern-day computer, that could be considered a retro challenge, quite within the parameters of the retro challenge. So just getting that all sort of set up, rather than getting a prepackaged version out of, I don't even know if Good Old Games has SimCity in its list, but that's an interesting piece of software there.
This particular one has all of the stuff, you know, like the manuals and the 3.5-inch disc, and you know, so that's also kind of neat too, just to see.
Well, that's the bit that I like. It's so easy to download disk images of a lot of this stuff, but I do like getting my hands on the original media and the bits and pieces that come in the box. To me, that's probably just as important as playing the game is having that up on the bookshelf with the other pieces of software. Okay, well, I found Alice. So Alice is an interesting piece of hardware. I've been looking for one of these for a while, if only because it looks pretty nifty. So this is a Tandy TRS-80 MC-10 clone, and it looks so much better than the MC-10. So
yeah, it's really nice.
So this is being sold by an Italian collector. It's I believe it's a French computer. Probably not really seen too much of these clones over in North America, but if you want to have a look at what was being done with some of the TRS-80 equipment of the day in other manufacturers, this one's quite stylish.
Yeah, I saw it looks pretty neat. I saw a picture of another Alice that looks more or less just like the MC-10, but except for that it's red. But whereas this one that you found, it's a very different sort of design. Yeah. I've never seen a computer with quite these sort of angled or cut off 45-degree angled corners in an interesting way.
One thing that's really cool about this, you know, the one that you found in the auction here, is that it has actual keys rather than that horrible MC-10 keyboard.
Yeah, and with its styling, it with maybe the other two corners trimmed a little bit, it would have looked perfect on the Battlestar Galactica reboot.
Oh, that's cool. So just sort of searching around the web for images and things. I don't know if this was actually really sold with it, but there's a picture of a red, you know, Alice connected to sort of similarly styled red cassette recorder that's That's pretty cool. I've seen, actually, yeah, there's a couple of these images around, so if you just, you know, whatever, Google Alice MC10 on images, you will probably see the ones I'm seeing, rather than linking into, like, someone's photo stream or whatever. But I have to say that I think the MC10, it's a pretty poorly capable machine, but...
It's an interesting description.
So you can get, for the MC10, you can get a memory expansion thing. I wonder if that'll fit in this little angled version.
Definitely have to have a look there, but I remember seeing a picture of this quite a while ago, and this one just popped up in one of my eBay save searches, and I thought, oh, that's perfect for the showcase for today. But probably not one of the better computers to be to be cloned, but at least this one looks nice.
Yeah, and it seems like it's a little bit expensive. Like, I'm not sure. I'm glad to have seen the pictures.
No, I don't think I'll be spending €99 for the opening bid. But there it is. If someone else is interested in bringing Alice home, here's the link for you. And pop over, have a look, put a bid in. Tell us how you went. Okay, Jack. This one's intriguing. Tell me more.
I have found perhaps the ultimate fashion accessory for any retro fan. This is a vintage Atari belt buckle. Not only is it a belt buckle, it is in fact also a white leather belt. Both the buckle and the belt have a little bit of Asteroids-inspired graphics on them. The belt is an oval orange shape with black Atari logo and some graphics on it. This is a very stylish item, and it is up for the amazing price of just under £2, £1.99 British. This is amazing. Zero bids so far. It's up for, as I'm reading this, 6 days and 21 more hours. So if you hear this show reasonably soon after release, you have a chance of bidding on this miracle. I may bid upon this myself, because for this price, I cannot imagine a finer white leather belt with an Atari belt buckle attached to it.
It is interesting. I see that on the back of it. It says Atari bonded leather, www.atari.com, which suggests that it is not that it is somewhat more recent than the video game system.
Yeah, I'm sure this at least is from the 90s and not earlier than that. But
it even has Asteroids on the belt itself.
Yeah, I'm concerned that another look. It says the size is listed as small/medium, so maybe I shouldn't get this. Not to wear, at least. I could get it just for the fun.
Now, for me, I think it'd have to come with an expansion kit.
Right.
Well, that is the wonderful world of eBay. Sometimes there's interesting things in there, and then sometimes there's interesting things. Okay, gentlemen, what have you got for me as some parting shots? Anything interesting happening? Have you come up with a retro challenge idea within the few minutes that we've discussed it?
I have not, but I can tell you one thing that I did recently order. I ordered a thing for my Atari 8-bit computer. It's this thing called the SAO to SD adapter. So basically, you put an SD card into your Atari, and the Atari will think it's a disk drive. Or the device lets you pick a folder on this, and the Atari will think that folder is a disk drive. This is a way to be able to sort of load up an SD card full of stuff and run it on your machine. I haven't got this yet, but I ordered one, and I'm pretty excited about it, I have to say.
Yeah, I think these kind of adapters and things for all of our retro computers are superb, especially gives us the ability to more easily use the software that's out there.
Yep.
So, yeah, definitely worth getting something like that if you want to get serious with your computers. So, Paul, narrow it down to just a couple of projects that you must have plenty going at the moment.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's always kind of like the same, much of the same stuff. I haven't really thought too hard about a retro challenge project, but there is something that has just been occupying all of my time, it seems like, which is essentially a programming project that has in order to convert a disk image read that comes off of an EDD card in an Apple II into something that emulators can use. And it's a harder project than it really should be, in a way, because it turns out that the card itself is not, it doesn't send a reliable signal exactly, you know, so sometimes it'll throw in an extra one, which, you know, so that's been an interesting project, and I've been banging my head against it for quite some time, but Maybe I can get that done in January, and maybe that can count as my retro challenge project.
So this is where the disc has got half or quarter tracking or other interesting bits and pieces, isn't it?
Yeah. The card itself can read at a sort of higher, basically a higher resolution than a normal Apple II controller card, even though it's not quite down to the flux level. And of course, if I just take flux reads of all of these, then you know, actually, the project would be much simpler. But what's an interesting challenge here is the fact that the disk drive, the Apple 5.25-inch disk drive controller, there's a sort of technical limitation where if it gets three zeros in a row, then the read amplifier starts. You know, it's basically like a leveling control, like a audio level control, where you know if there's no sound, then it just keeps turning up the volume until it gets something. And so after three zeros, you're always at risk of getting like an extra one that's not on the disc because it just keeps looking for something. And you know, so I've learned a lot actually about how like the very low level disc formatting and so forth on the Apple, but I still can't get this program to quite work on everything, particularly the protected discs. It works fine on unprotected discs, but you know, I didn't need to do this for those.
Yeah. Well, nothing much retro has been happening at my end of the world, just a few eBay bits and pieces coming through, but nothing overly interesting, just some software bits, so just get some scanning done and disk images done for these, because I haven't found a disk image for a few of these bits, but and definitely no good PDF scans, so I'll take care of that as well, but nothing earth-shattering in the retro world. Okay, well, that's it for this show. You can find show notes for all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vintagecomputer.com and the VC forum. You can follow the RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. And you can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we're a member of the Throwback Network, where you can find all retro things of interest, not just computers. And please write us a review on iTunes so that you can help other people find us. So, folks, until next time,
Retro Compute.